If you're looking at your phone right now, you've found us on mobile, which means we can get a move on. You know me, you know what this is, so let's begin.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. Louisiana imprisons more people per capita than any other state in the country. The Pelican State is also home to the nation's largest prison, the Louisiana State Penitentiary, the notorious prison, also known as Angola. Albert Woodfox has spent most of his life in Angola, and for the last 43 years, he's lived in a 55-square-foot cell all alone. His original conviction was for armed robbery, but once inside, Woodfox was convicted of stabbing a prison guard in 1972. He's been in solitary confinement ever since, all the time claiming his innocence. Here he is speaking to the director for the 2010 documentary about his case called In the Land of the Free.
The cells are very small, you know. It's smaller than most bathrooms are, you know. Maybe 4 or 5 steps the length of the cell, and about 3 steps the width, you know.
Woodfox has been tried and convicted for the guard's murder twice, and both convictions were thrown out by higher courts. In February, he was indicted again on the same murder charge, but this week, a federal judge ruled that Woodfox has to be released from Angola and that he shouldn't have to face another trial. Louisiana's attorney general has appealed, and today we'll learn whether Woodfox will finally be returned to life outside Angola or if he'll stay in prison through yet another appeal. Joining us now is Wilbert Rito, who spent 44 years in prison, most of them in Angola. He wrote about Woodfox for Angola's award-winning prison newspaper, and today he's the author of the memoir In the Place of Justice, and he joins me now. Mr. Rito, welcome.
Hello, Todd.
How did you come to write about the case of Albert Woodfox?
Well, actually, as editor of the prison magazine, I had heard about Woodfox, and I requested a listing of all the people in the prison who had been locked up, in fact, in the state of Louisiana, who had been confined in a cell for over 15 years. And they sent me a list, and there were 5 who were over 20 years. And Woodfox was one of them, as was his co-defendant, Herman Wallace, and a third person. And what I did is I didn't actually write about him. I sent a reporter and a photographer over to the CCR building to photograph him and interview him. And we ran a feature on him. And it was a rather pleasant experience. Nowadays, it's difficult to even get a whisper into him. You know, they're so tight and uncooperative.
You're talking about the famous case of the Angola Three, which people can look up and read about. It's fascinating and heartbreaking in a lot of ways. Wilbert Rito, you spent 12 and a half years in solitary yourself.
I did.
So you've got a great deal of experience and, I imagine, empathy for Albert Woodfox. Can you give us a sense of what he might be facing emotionally at this point after so much time in solitary and the prospect of finally being released here?
Well, it's difficult for anyone who's been confined a very long period of time. And in this instance, you're talking about Woodfox. He was confined for, what we're talking about, over 4 decades, the same as I was. His was in a cell. Mine was, you know, just the first 12 were in a cell. But he spent, you have to understand, he spent his time in a cell in as productive a way as possible. He read exhaustively, educated himself, and chances are he could probably discuss political issues and the world's problems better than most people in this country. He's very well read, and he's improved his mind. The problem he would have, as most people would have, even I had, is that you get out of prison and there's no support. I mean, you know, I got out of prison. I didn't have a dime to my name, no job, no anything. Contrary to that, if he gets out, he has a support system, something that even the judge noted in his order to release him, is that there's a support system to give him, to take care of him and get him medical care, which he is in dire need of because he hasn't received any medical treatment and he's an ill man.
And as you say, we're going to hear today about whether or not he gets out, and it's the subject of years and years of legal wrangling. Let me read a statement from the Louisiana Attorney General, Buddy Caldwell. His office issued this statement upon the issuance of the district court decision to let Albert Woodfox out. He says, with this order, the court would see fit to set free a twice-convicted murderer who is awaiting trial again for the brutal slaying of a corrections officer named Brent Miller. This order arbitrarily sets aside jury decisions, gives a free pass to a murderer based on faulty procedural issues. Our office is seeking an emergency stay from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit to make sure this murderer stays in prison and is held fully accountable for his actions. Mr. Rito, the legal wrangling aside, one thing that Albert Fox might be facing here is the prospect of going from, you know, an 11 by 5 box for 23 hours a day, or at least that's what I assume, to a wide open world. And despite the health of his mind, if not the health of his body, that's got to be an emotional situation that's unimaginable for the vast majority of us.
Will be, but understand, when I emerged from my 12 and a half years in solitary in a cell, I was placed in general population in the bloodiest prison in the United States. I functioned fine, you know? He will too. And everybody talks about how bad, how destructive a force that solitary is on human beings. And I'll grant you, it's the cruelest thing you will ever do to another human being. But the fact is, the effect of the experience is like every other human experience. It has to do with the individual, and it affects individuals differently. Some individuals are crushed totally by the experience, like Khalif Browder up at Rikers Island. He committed suicide because he couldn't overcome, come to terms with the experience. But I didn't, and most guys don't. They manage. And I have no doubt that Woodfox would do well in society once he gets past his medical needs. He'll be a productive and law-abiding citizen, just as I've been for the past 10 years.
We should find out later today whether Albert Woodfox, who's been in Angola prison for 43 years, will finally be released per a judge's order after two trials for the murder of a prison guard and a third trial potentially on the way. Wilbert Rito, who spent 44 years in Angola himself and has written or at least edited newspaper articles about Albert Woodfox, has joined us. Wilbert, thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd.
We turn now to another story about justice, this time with the Catholic Church.
Today, what the facts are and what the law allows and what justice requires is that we file criminal charges against the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis for its role in failing to protect children and contributing to the unspeakable harm that was done to three young sexual abuse victims of Curtis Waymire.
That's Ramsey County Attorney John Choi speaking there last week, announcing criminal charges against the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis in Minnesota for its failure to protect children, specifically three victims who suffered sexual abuse at the hands of a former priest named Curtis Waymire. Waymire pleaded guilty in November 2012 and is currently serving a five-year prison sentence. Madeline Barron is a reporter for Minnesota Public Radio who helped open the investigation, and she says the charges against the Archdiocese are historic.
These are six counts, criminal counts, against the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis, so against the corporation itself. They're all gross misdemeanors, and they are kind of unusual charges. Three of them say that the Archdiocese made decisions that caused children to need protection or services. And then the other three charges say that basically that they contributed to the delinquency of minors.
So in layman's terms, is this essentially the Archdiocese knew or had reason to know that this priest was abusing children and didn't report it or concealed it?
In this case, we don't have any evidence that suggests that they knew that this priest, Curtis Waymire, the one who's in prison, was abusing children and kept him in ministry, but they did ignore a lot of red flags. So this was a priest who had approached younger men for sex in a bookstore. He'd been caught cruising in a public park. He had been to treatment for sexual issues. So this was someone who was definitely showing a lot of warning signs, and yet the archbishop not only kept him in ministry, but put him in charge of two parishes. And then he went on to abuse the sons of a parish employee, this priest did. So what the prosecutor is basically saying is that this could have been prevented, that if church officials had taken adequate steps, that these children would not have been abused.
So one of the many, many layers of the terrible sexual abuse scandal within the Catholic Church has been not only the abuse at the hands of priests themselves, but in some cases, the institutional concealment or turning of a blind eye on the part of the church. And that's what this speaks to here.
Right. And what's so striking is that this isn't something in this archdiocese that happened decades ago. We're talking about decisions that were made 3 years ago, 4 years ago. So it shows that this clergy sexual abuse scandal is not a thing of the past. It's very much present. And that really raises questions about how to hold bishops accountable for how they handle these priests.
Well, what does it mean in that case, then, to have criminal charges against the institution of the church, or in this case, the Archdiocese of Minneapolis?
It's very rare for any archdiocese in the United States to be criminally charged. It's also rare for a bishop to be criminally charged for their handling of this. The best example I could find of a diocese being charged was the Archdiocese of Cincinnati. In 2003, they were fined $10,000 for failing to report priests who are accused of abusing children. So this is very rare. And what it means, I mean, victims have kind of a mixed reaction to this, because on the one hand, they're glad to see charges, any kind of charges for this cover-up. But on the other hand, if you charge the institution, no one goes to prison.
Madeline Barron, there's no chance that Curtis Wehmeyer is unique. There's almost no chance that the Archdiocese of Minneapolis in this regard is unique. So what are other prosecutors in other jurisdictions or even other archdioceses thinking today?
Well, that is a good question. I think that historically still we've seen that most bishops who engage in inappropriate handling of abuse cases don't see any kind of punishment. So we're not at a point, it's not as though we're in a wave of these types of prosecutions. So still, for the most part, bishops are not prosecuted. One example, though, similar to this is in Kansas City. The archbishop there, who's since resigned, Bishop Finn, he was criminally charged for failing to report a priest who immediately reported a priest who had child pornography. But by and large, you know, we're not seeing that kind of aggressive nationwide approach of prosecutors. And in some cases, in part, it's because by the time that police figure out that the church has been covering this up, it's too late to file charges. You know, ironically, if you can cover it up long enough, you're past the statute of limitations in a lot of cases.
Charges in Minneapolis, a prosecutor there filing charges against the Archdiocese of Minneapolis for concealing or failing to report known sexual abuse against children at the hands of a priest. Madeline Barron, reporter with Minnesota Public Radio. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
The Ebola epidemic in West Africa is nearly over. There are just a few cases still popping up, but only a shade of the dozens of infections per day and rampant spread of last year. With more than 11,000 people dead and 27,000 suspected cases, it was the largest epidemic of hemorrhagic fever ever recorded. If the international community hadn't acted and fast, the Centers for Disease Control predicted that Ebola could have infected 1.4 million people.
Every month of delay more than doubled the number of cases that might occur because of that delay. So the model ultimately showed not only the problem, but the need to solve it by going big and going fast.
That's Martin Meltzer. He heads the CDC's modeling team. PBS science correspondent Miles O'Brien recently traveled to Sierra Leone, where the epidemic is believed to have started in December 2013, and to Liberia, which had the highest death toll in all of West Africa, to better understand what we've learned from the crisis and what might prepare us for the next one.
You know, a lot of people criticized the CDC for putting out that high number. The concern that was brought forward was that it was kind of a Chicken Little kind of number. But to the extent that it galvanized a focused response in West Africa, I think you can say that was a successful outcome. The number, if you listen to what was presented at that time, was if we do nothing, this is what will happen. It was a stark outcome which would have put the Ebola epidemic really all over the planet. And it was absolutely mandatory that the West respond and respond quickly.
And one of the things that was key here were public health authorities, both in Sierra Leone, Liberia, and other countries, and from the West, getting to people quickly to see if they had fever, see if they were sick, to isolate them. How did that effort ramp up over time to head off this disease? Because it's so critical to get people, you know, within the first day or two of when they first feel ill. It's not easy.
it's not easy because you had all kinds of things against you. This is as poor a place on the planet as you will find. And the infrastructure is just not there. The medical capability, the ability to respond, the isolation units, just the sheer numbers of medical professionals, all of these things put them at a huge disadvantage. And when you're dealing with exponential growth, when you get behind something like this, when you get behind the power curve, to borrow a pilot expression, you really have a very difficult time getting ahead of it. And the magic number, as it turns out, was about 70% of the cases. If 70% of the cases could be treated with proper isolation, if you could get to the point where 70% of the burials were done without the ritual cleansing of the body, that exponential growth curve all of a sudden became an exponential decline. And that's precisely what happened. So really what really beat Ebola in this case was education.
You went along with public health teams as they were going into some of these very remote villages and confronting cases as they were happening. And here's one doctor, Patrick O'Team, who you talked to.
The moment they have any other symptoms, so just fever or a headache or joint pain or sore throat, then you need to be very proactive.
Basically, you're fighting Ebola with a thermometer.
Yes.
Which
yes.
seems like you could do, we could do better in this day and age, right?
Yeah. It seems we could do better, but unfortunately, that's all we have for now.
Fighting Ebola with a thermometer. Miles O'Brien shooting an infrared thermometer at the temples of children and adults who might be affected. A better thing would be to have a rapid, reliable test that could test for Ebola, and if somebody is sick, get them isolated right away. Where are we at with a rapid test? Will we have one the next time Ebola inevitably hits this part of the world?
I think we will, Todd. There are a couple of interesting ideas at play right now. We went to MIT, where a team led by biologist Lee Gehrke is working on a strip test, not unlike an early pregnancy test. He's providing do-it-yourself kits for local health workers. And when you do something like that, it becomes much more self-sustaining. And I think as those kits get into play and as healthcare workers on the ground get a sense of how that can be done, I think the next go-round, there'll be something in play. And that will be very, very useful towards stemming an epidemic.
And the other holy grail here, of course, is vaccine. Now, the development of a vaccine has confronted all of the things you've talked about. It hasn't been worth the money for vaccine companies. Nobody's really put the investment into it. Where does that effort stand?
Well, the vaccine trials are underway in West Africa, and they did get them into human trials in record time for a vaccine trial. But it wasn't soon enough. The interesting twist of irony here is that the public health measures, which we just talked about, that education, which caused that exponential curve to go on the downslope, took away the opportunity to test the vaccine in a large cohort. Now, this is an outcome we all hope for, fewer and fewer Ebola cases, and we're bouncing very close to zero in the region. Liberia is now officially at zero, but it's not over yet. But the cohort, the group of people you could test on, doesn't exist anymore. The trials are marching forward, however.
Miles O'Brien, let's take a second before we go here and just talk about the domestic scene here in the United States. A lot of us who follow the science and sort of the real work that goes on behind the scenes in stemming an epidemic and the realities of what it takes to get sick from Ebola, we're pretty disgusted, I would say, with some of the domestic reaction and the fear-mongering that went on when there were one or two cases of this disease in the United States, a doctor in New York City, somebody else in Texas. What have we learned here in the United States, do you think, that the next time Ebola comes around, and it will come around again, that we handle it a little bit differently?
Well, I hope that people will take the time to understand what Ebola is and what it really can do. In the first world, at a place like NIH or Emory University, Ebola is manageable even without a vaccine. The human body can fight off Ebola as long as you can keep the human being alive long enough. That's the trick. And in intensive care in the United States, that will almost always happen. So it's important to understand that the epidemic we saw in West Africa was as much as anything a function of poverty and lack of medical infrastructure. And so I think it's really horrible that there were some quarters in the political world and in the media world that made this seem much scarier than it is, also in, frankly, in the context of an election. So, you know, this is another consequence of our scientific illiteracy in this country, frankly, and I think it's really important for people to stop and understand these things. It is scary. Ebola is scary, but it's not a threat that's going to create this huge epidemic in the United States the way it was portrayed back in the fall.
The inside story of what went wrong and really what went right as public health workers in the international community and residents in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and other parts of West Africa dealt with the horrible Ebola epidemic. Miles O'Brien, science correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Todd.
You can catch the four-part series Cracking Ebola's Code all this week on the PBS NewsHour.
This podcast of The Takeaway is brought to you by the fine folks at WNYC and Public Radio International. I'm John Hockenberry. Our partners include WGBH, Boston Public Radio, and The New York Times. If you'd like to know more about the program, you can find out more about me and the team at thetakeaway.org.
Jurassic Park is frightening in the dark. All the dinosaurs are running wild. Someone let T-Rex out of his pen. I'm afraid those things will harm me, 'cause they sure don't act like Barney, and they think that I'm their dinner, not their friend. Oh no!
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you today. And yes, we're going back to Jurassic World this weekend. We're going big on the fourth installment of Jurassic Park. It's called Jurassic World this time on our Friday movie day. And with me now in the studio, Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, and Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway. Together, they are the hosts of the Movie Date podcast. Guys, welcome.
Hey, Todd.
Hey, Todd.
Back to Jurassic World. As I said, this is the fourth installment in the long anthology that has become Jurassic Park. So let's do a little bit of trivia. I have Jurassic Park trivia for you today. Now, don't answer, because we're going to get your answer at the end of the segment. Here's your question. Going back to Jurassic Park 1993, what key aspect of Jurassic Park is part dog, part penguin, part tiger, part alligator, and part elephant? Think about that. Don't answer now, because it's going to come back at you in just a couple of minutes. All right, guys, Jurassic World, directed by Colin Trevorrow. Now, he's only ever directed, as I understand it, one other film. I loved that tiny little film, Safety Not Guaranteed, with Aubrey Plaza. This is not a tiny little film, though, Kristen Meinzer. This is a great big one.
Oh, no. This is all, you know, pyrotechnics, special effects, CGI. It's dinosaurs. And again, the dinosaurs are crossed with all sorts of other kinds of things, everything from cuttlefish to animals you can't even imagine. And much like the other Jurassic Parks, we have to learn a lesson about whether or not humans can actually control nature. And, well, we usually know what happens in these cases.
All right, Rafer Guzman, before I go to you, let's listen to a clip from Jurassic World.
Look, I get it. You're in charge out here. You got to make a lot of tough decisions. It's probably easier to pretend these animals are just numbers on a spreadsheet. But they're not. They're alive.
I'm fully aware they're alive.
You might have made them in a test tube. But they don't know that. They're thinking, I gotta eat. I gotta hunt. I gotta... You can relate to at least one of those things, right?
Rafer Guzman, there's Chris Pratt as the action star of Jurassic World. What'd you think?
Right, and that's Bryce Dallas Howard, who's playing the Jurassic executive that he's flirting with. Not a lot of chemistry between those two, unfortunately, but here's the thing. Colin Trevorrow, the guy who did Safety Not Guaranteed, also one of my favorite films from the last couple of years. Basically, what he's doing is just remaking the first Jurassic Park. This is almost a beat-for-beat, scene-for-scene repeat of Jurassic Park. Do you remember when the kids get trapped in the Ford Explorer and the dinosaur kind of bats them around like a cat toy? Same scene, only now they're in kind of a gyroscope pod, so it's a little bit modern, a little bit more cool-looking. It's the exact same scene. The whole movie unfolds like that. It's all done with, like, a lot of skill, a lot of energy. Trevorrow seems to have, like, really seen his Spielberg movies, so I think he knows what he's doing. Essentially, I would say this is not, like, the big bang-up wow that you're waiting for from Jurassic Park, but it's pretty good, if only because it's exactly like the first Jurassic Park.
So if you knew what you liked from the first Jurassic Park and 2 and 3, you might find something that you like in Jurassic World. All right,
that's exactly
the big
right.
blockbuster from this weekend. All right, now let's go a little bit smaller now. Guys, let's hear a clip from Me and Earl and the Dying Girl that's out this weekend from director Alfonso Gomez-Rejon.
Rachel's been diagnosed with leukemia. They just found out.
Oh, God. Is that serious?
They're doing all kinds of tests. They're doing everything they can. They just don't know.
Man, that sucks.
You're right. It sucks.
It sucks really bad.
It sucks quite a bit.
I heard Nick Offerman at the end there, Rafer.
Yes, indeed. He plays the father of the main character, Greg, played by Thomas Mann. He's this kid who's kind of trying to skim his way through high school, not make any deep connections, hang out with the goths a little bit, hang out with the jocks a little bit, not really get himself too much in deep with anybody, but his mother kind of forces him to make a connection with this dying girl, Rachel, who has leukemia. This is, I think, one of these teenage films in the mold of Fault in Our Stars and Spectacular Now, a little tear-jerking, a little bit of quirkiness. I like the movie okay. I feel that it really goes overboard on the quirk. Everyone here is an extremely quirky, oddball, different, weird, wacky character, and it all gets to be a bit much, and you kind of, everyone's humanity gets a little bit lost in sort of the eccentric overload of this film. But I didn't think it was a bad film. I thought it was all right.
All right, Kristen Meinzer?
Yeah, well, I have to agree that there is some major quirk happening here. Everything has a heading. The moment I meet the dying girl, the moment when I realize Earl and I are doing this, the moment... So there are these headlines, these quirky personalities, everything's adorably overloaded and yet completely emotionally empty, I have to say. I didn't laugh once during the movie, but a much bigger problem is I did not cry. I do not want to see a movie with a dying teenage girl and not cry. I want to cry, and there were no tears.
Adorably overloaded is the takeaway from me and Earl and the Dying Girl. There is not much adorability probably in Jurassic World. Guys, let's go back to trivia before I let you go. I asked you from Jurassic Park in 1993, Kristen Meinzer, get ready. What key aspect of Jurassic Park is part dog, part penguin, part tiger, part alligator, and part elephant?
A human being?
Rafer Guzman?
I gotta say, I'm drawing a blank. You stumped me, Todd.
Director Jay? That's the roar of T-Rex. T-Rex's roar is a combination of all those. Gotcha, guys. That's my favorite part of this whole thing. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Kristen Meinzer, culture producer here at The Takeaway and co-hosts of the Movie Date podcast. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Todd.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you today. So here's a question we've been asking you, to tip or not to tip. From Portland, Oregon, no, I don't trust restaurant owners to adequately subsidize employees. Too much would go into the owner's pockets. Better tips come from better service. Okay, that's one take, but what if restaurant owners did pay their staff at least $35,000 a year, plus health benefits, plus vacation days, company shares, and on top of all that, annual bonuses, but at the same time did away once and for all with tipping? Well, it would mean that owners and not customers were paying the salaries of restaurant workers, but what would the employees think? Would they revolt or would they like it?
Getting tips, you know, it's very much a boom and bust way of going about things. We'd have some days where, you know, everything is really crazy and busy and you have a lot of money at the end of the night and it's, you know, tiring but cool. And then a lot of days where it might be slower, and when you finally go home, it's pretty pretty depressing because you maybe don't have much money to show for the time.
That's Andrew. He's one of the service staff at Bar Marco. That's a restaurant in Pittsburgh that eliminated the tip-based model in the spring in favor of the salary model, one a lot like the one I just described. Bobby Fry is the owner at Bar Marco, and he's here to explain why he decided to change things and how it's working out down at his restaurant. Hi, Bobby.
Hey, how are you today?
I'm great, thanks. So I got it right. About $35,000 is what you pay staff. They get vacation days, 500 company shares, bonuses, and no tipping at all. Is that about right?
That's correct. We do not accept gratuity.
All right. So what made you decide to go this route, this sort of revolutionary route for the American restaurant?
Well, that's kind of the interesting thing. I think a lot of people would probably assume that we sat down one day and said, you know what, we're going to eliminate tipping and let's figure out how to make it work. When in fact, we thought that that would be a good solution to three, I would guess you call them problems, that we wanted to proactively avoid that hit restaurants between years 3 and 5.
What are the three problems that you were trying to avoid?
Well, the first one is that most of the time, you know, if you've been around for 3 years, that means you're busy and people like what you do. And revenue starts to hide your problems. It's already a very low margin industry. You start to get inefficient with your use of product, use too many towels, use too much water. And your solution to that is oftentimes to hire a manager who's relatively expensive to police all those costs. The second problem is the imbalance of pay between the front of the house, the people serving your food, and the back of the house, the people preparing your food. And the third is that oftentimes, you know, workers are incentivized to work just the busiest shifts. So then you have too many part-time workers who then end up being the face of your business on maybe the slower days, which creates some inconsistencies with your service. And we really wanted to set this more up like a business.
All right. Well, we talked to some of your staff about the changes, Bobby. Here's what Jocelyn said. She's your service director. Listen.
It gives us the ability to look at each other and say, hey, we're on the same team. We make the same amount of money, instead of kind of being in a cutthroat world, which it can be in the service industry, trying to, you know, take tables from each other. It really makes us communicate better, be organized together. You know, it changes how you view your position as a professional in the service industry.
Now, Bobby Fry, I appreciate what she's saying. I don't expect one of your employees to say they hate your policies while they're on the radio, so maybe we'll take that into account. But, you know, when I first heard about this, I thought it was a little crazy, because everybody knows, or at least the conventional wisdom, is that all of the cost in your business is in the labor, and that's why restaurants pay servers $3 an hour and customers make up the rest in tips, because all the cost is in the employees. Now, you're paying everybody a flat rate of $35,000, and I thought, well, that can't work, but I guess I don't know what I'm talking about.
Well, here's the thing. You coined the term perfectly, conventional wisdom, which I think was brought about in the 50s by one of my favorite economists, John Kenneth Galbraith, and it means things that sound like they make sense, but they actually don't. So what we did was, you know, I started saying, okay, what would my perfect team look like? And I built that perfect team on many whiteboards and spreadsheets. And then I said, okay, what would I have to pay them fairly and pay them at the industry standard, which would be anywhere from 25 to 32% of your revenue. And then I said, okay, well, what does that revenue look like? And I said, wow, that's like $200,000 less than we even made last year. And what you found out is the real costs are the 40% overhead that are not labor or cost of goods sold, from your rent, your insurance, to all of your hidden costs. And, you know, we've seen those drop from 40% to 28% just because we brought the whole team into the conversations.
Now, when I was a waiter earlier in my life, I loved the incentive of a Saturday night and going home with a big wad of money in my pocket because the place was so busy. But not everybody necessarily agrees. Listen to Andrew. He's a guy who's worked at several different places around your restaurant.
This kind of mentality allows us to think about this as a career instead of just like a side job. And I've started to realize that it's something I want to do for a longer period of time, that Pittsburgh is a city I want to be in, and the food and drink scene in particular is really an exciting place. And so I want to, you know, put down root. And it's pretty hard to get a mortgage on. I'll make money sometimes, but I'm not sure how much, if you say that to the bank.
Well, Bobby, he's got a point. When I was a waiter, I never thought I would stay with my employer. I was there for a few months or the summer, going to make as much as I can in tips, and then I was out of there.
Yeah, I mean, I think the interesting thing is we've had four of our employees in 3 years go on to start their own businesses out of our restaurants. So, you know, I think you can look at it a career, but one way or another, it is not an acceptable business practice to give people wads of cash at the end of the night. It's not a sustainable way to run a business.
And just to talk about sustainability, I know you're getting a lot of media attention, and that's helping the bottom line for sure. But what about customers, your return customers? Do they love the idea of just signing the bottom line and not adding up 20%?
Yeah, I mean, we consulted with a lot of our, you know, our regulars. I mean, you know, a lot of the return customers are thrilled with it. And I think it opens up a bigger conversation in America, which is how do we pay the employees in our society that are on the lower end of the food chain? If you view your labor force as an asset, by keeping wages too low, you're incentivizing managers and strategists and CEOs to undervalue those assets.
Well, they're not just flipping plates at Bar Marco in Pittsburgh. They're flipping conventional wisdom of the restaurant business on its head. Absolutely no tipping allowed, And the servers, well, they get a salary. They have real jobs. Bobby Fry, owner of Bar Marco, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
So here's a final thought if you happen to get stuck in traffic this weekend. Take comfort in the fact that you're going to be out of the car long before the drivers in the world's oldest sports car race, which gets underway tomorrow in France. The 24-hour Le Mans race has been testing drivers every year since 1923, and this is a feat of mechanical and physical endurance. Assuming no one breaks down or runs out of fuel, the drivers will have covered more than 3,000 miles, which kind of makes the Indy 500 look like a walk in the park and makes pulling off at a rest stop seem like a fantasy. Well, that's all for today. If you're new to The Takeaway this week, we want you to be part of our daily conversation, be part of our listener response network by signing up for our text. Now, you'll get one text each day where we ask you a question featured on the next day's show. So your voice becomes part of the on-air conversation with us. Just text the word START to 69866. That's START to 69866. Messaging and data rates may apply. You can reply STOP to opt out. Safe travels this weekend. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.